Okay. The second pep talk, which will to some sound like part two of what I just talked about, but that's not really what I intended. It's more like part two to what I talked about last Sunday, and hopefully this will become clear as I get into it. Last Sunday, I wanted to give the sermon an edgy title using language that would not be all that appropriate for a church setting or really any setting. I face the same thing today, and so in the interest of keeping everything in good taste, I'm going with when to tell our civil authorities heck no and when not to. And as you can see, this is not part of the series on unanswered prayer. We will return to that. I promise we will get there. I'm eager to return to it. But like last week, I feel that there's something a bit more timely and pressing to get into. Ever since the government lockdown in March and April, and now the mandatory rules on wearing masks, there's been quite a bit of concern and discussion about government overreach, especially as it pertains to our personal lives and even the operations of a church. You are probably aware that in some states, churches face heavy restrictions on their gatherings. In some cases, gatherings right now are actually, in-person gatherings are actually forbidden. So this sermon isn't exactly about government-ordered lockdowns or masks or other measures that have been imposed, though I will borrow them as examples, but that's not really what this is about. Basically, I simply want to focus in on the role of the state and the principles involved when it comes to our submission to it, or lack thereof. And the bottom line of today's message is the same as that of last Sunday's. Let us not be reckless fools. Let us think. Let's exercise some wisdom and be very careful with all of this because the world is watching and these are matters that God is concerned about. Now, given the history of abuse through the centuries when it comes to authorities ruling over a population, these recent concerns of overreach, of course, are not unfounded. Even here in America, where personal liberty and religious freedom enjoys a good measure of favor, we are not really out of line to be a bit unsettled when something seems to be overly restrictive. That said, we are also aware, or should be, of what the Bible teaches regarding our obligation to respect, honor, and obey the leaders of our government and their laws. Indeed, this is to be our default position. All things being equal, we are to be good citizens, submissive, loyal, obedient, respectful, agreeable, law-abiding. And one of the reasons for that is that God is concerned about our reputations, something that is raised time and time again in the New Testament. God doesn't want outsiders to think of us as anti-government rebels, troublemakers, defiant, who show contempt to civil leaders and or the laws of the land. And another reason is because government serves his purpose in the world, and it can't do that if we take it upon ourselves to resist it, disobey it, and be antagonistic toward it. To push back against the state is to push back against God who ordained the state. And so we should be very careful in our responses when faced with laws and mandates that we disagree with, or believed to be silly, or unnecessary, or unreasonable. But as you know, there are situations that do require disobedience, or what I like to call respectful noncompliance. We are not to blindly yield to any civil authority who requires us to disobey a command of God, or who forbids us to do what God has ordered us to do. Church history is filled with countless examples of Christians declaring by their words and actions, we must obey God rather than man. Indeed, unconditional obedience to the state amounts to nothing less than idolatry. And I think we all understand this. But on the other hand, willfully defying the state for unfounded reasons is no small matter before the Lord. In fact, it is to willfully disobey Him. And this should sober us. It should rein us in. It should cause us to pause and think through situations very carefully. Civil disobedience is a serious thing, and we need to just be very, very careful when entertaining that as an option. It's not something that we are to engage in lightly, flippantly, or casually. A few verses are in order as a way of reminder. You are familiar with these, but this morning we will read through them again. In 1 Peter chapter 2, be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether it be to the emperor as supreme or to governors as sent by him to punish those who do evil and to praise those who do good. For this is the will of God, that by doing so you should put to silence the ignorance of foolish people. Live as people who are free, not using your freedom as a cover-up for evil, but living as servants of God. Honor everyone, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the emperor. Titus 3, remind them to be submissive to rulers and authorities, to be obedient, to be ready for every good work, to speak evil of no one, to avoid quarreling, to be gentle, and to show perfect courtesy toward all people. 1 Timothy 2, first of all, then, I urge that supplications, prayers, intercessions, and thanksgivings be made for all people, for kings and all who are in high positions, that we may lead a peaceful and quiet life, godly and dignified in every way. This is good, and it is pleasing in the sight of God our Savior, who desires all people to be saved and to come to a knowledge of the truth. And of course, Romans 13. Let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authorities resists what God has appointed, and those who resist will incur judgment. For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. When you have no fear of the one who is in authority, then do what is good, and you will receive his approval, for he is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain, for he is a servant of God, an avenger who carries out God's wrath on the wrongdoer. Therefore, one must be in subjection, not only to avoid God's wrath, but also for the sake of conscience. Well, these passages are very clear. They stand on their own. They can't really be construed to mean something other than what they say. With one voice, they, and for that matter, the whole council in the New Testament, is a call to be model citizens, to obey the laws of the land, and to respect its kings, governors, magistrates, presidents, city mayors, and county sheriffs. This is our default position. This is how we are to live and how we are to speak of our leaders, unless there is, of course, a biblically justifiable reason not to. We can only break ranks from that in those rare situations when there is a conflict with God's law, when they require me to do something God has forbidden or forbid me to do something God has required. We are not afforded the option of disregarding civil laws or mandates that we don't like or are inconvenienced by or think are unnecessary or because we suspect a sinister hidden agenda. Now, unfortunately, as Americans, we are somewhat conditioned to buck the system. It's just in our DNA. It's part of our heritage, you know, revolutions and protests and defying unjust leaders. That's the American way. This rugged individualism. We are free and independent. The leaders work for us, and they better not forget it. And this is how we've been brought up. You know, obey when it makes sense to, obey when it's convenient to, obey when it serves your purpose. If truth be told, the primary driving factor behind most of our obedience, I would wager, is fear of punishment. We would drive 50 in that 30-mile-an-hour speed zone were it not for the fear of an expensive speeding ticket and subsequent surge in our insurance premiums. But a much better motivation for obedience is that of valuing civil authority for what it is. It is a blessing from God. God uses government to restrain evil, protect us from the wicked, to order society so that we can function as a civilization, to safeguard our land from threatening enemies, to ensure fairness for all, and so much more. We all want law and order. We all see the benefits of a government. Now, whether government does a good job of that is, of course, another question. But even with all of its flaws and unjust laws and unjust rulers, the advantages far outweigh the disadvantages. The alternative, anarchy, would be a nightmare for everyone. John Calvin once said, "It is bad to live under a prince who permits nothing, but much worse to live under one who permits everything." Anarchy is the prince that permits everything. And yet, by our casual disregard for civil laws and civil authorities, we are in that actually watering the seed of anarchy. One of the ways we express our appreciation to God for this gift of civil government is to honor it as such, as in our obedience to it and respect for it. Even as compliance and obedience should be our default action, respect and appreciation should be our default attitude. Now, as many of you know, I'm no stranger to civil disobedience. In the past, I recruited hundreds of people to join me in it. And even now, once a year, I teach a class on the ethics of civil disobedience to created equal interns. But even so, I just need to punch this yet again. I would say that we need to appreciate the gravity of willfully disobeying the state, whatever it might be. Such an action cannot be taken lightly. We have to be very careful with that whole thing. And this, as Paul told the Romans, because of the sake of conscience and for the sake of the Lord, as he also said. So I have learned from certain of Facebook spies that in recent weeks, a number of pastors and church leaders from all over, locally and regionally and all nationally, all over the place, have used Facebook to stir up a pushback against the government attitude over the mandate to wear masks. And this resistance is backed up by three claims. The governor, whatever the state might be, has no authority to make such an order. Masks are ineffective and unnecessary. And if we don't stop them now, more oppressive measures will come later on. And all that may actually be true. I don't know. It would take people smarter than me with more time and energy and resources than me to figure all that out. True or not, the thing I'm a little troubled by are the unintended consequences of such posts. Unintended. Is this really the issue that we want to quarrel about on Facebook and get everybody all stirred up over? Is there not a risk of instilling in the reader an antagonistic attitude toward civil authority? You know, that's just already deepening an unhealthy, they are the enemy view that many Christians unfortunately have. Would it not be better to save our ammo, this unified call to take a stand for the bigger battles that lie ahead? And there are bigger battles that are coming our way. And more to the point, what do outsiders think about all of this? And very important, can civil disobedience actually be justified on this mandate to wear masks? Does it really meet the criteria for that? So I just kind of wonder about the value of picking this fight at this time. Now, one fight that might be worth engaging is this effort to impose really stringent restrictions on church gatherings. Nevada's governor has limited casinos, restaurants, and amusement parks to 50% of their fire code capacities. Churches, however, regardless of how big their stadium or auditorium or sanctuary is, they are subjected to a flat 50-person limit, period. So that seems really unfair. And it really does seem unfair. California is limiting churches in some counties to 25% capacity, not to exceed 100 people, and they are forbidding singing. No singing even in home Bible studies. And in 30 counties in California, the most densely populated, the governor is forbidding churches to even meet at all. No church gatherings, period, at least in person inside. And this involves about 80% of California's population. Some of those areas, fines can go up to $1,000 a day. And now they are threatening to shut off the utilities to churches that do go ahead and hold services. Some churches are suing for protection. Others, like John MacArthur's Grace Community Church, are openly defying the order. Others are meeting outside. Others yet are doing the online virtual thing. The response has been all over the board on this. In California, discrimination against churches will be kind of hard to prove, given that the governor has also closed down all the bars, restaurants, family entertainment centers, or he's closed down all the bars, and restaurants, family entertainment centers, zoos and museums, and so forth are limited to just outdoor activities. But he has given his blessing to large gatherings of Black Lives Matter demonstrations, and this inconsistency has stirred things up and could be a problem for him in the courts, but I don't know. I mean, those demonstrations usually don't take place inside, they're outside, so it's hard to say how all this will work out. The question for us this morning is, what is the correct response to something like that? Well, every case is different. Different states with different mandates. There's other states besides California and Nevada. There's many who are imposing strict measures on churches. Different churches with different sizes facing different rules. It's not a one-size-fits-all kind of thing. I would see this forbidding church gatherings meeting the criteria for respectful noncompliance more than the mandate to wear masks. The fellowship of the saints is a central sacrament of the church. It's not something we would just casually set aside. But even so, I'm not 100% sure. A lot of careful thought would have to go into this. And that's kind of what I'm doing here today, is just thinking about it openly, inviting you to join me in this. You know, for the sake of the exercise, there are some questions that would just need to be entered into on that decision. And so I'm not going to come to any hard decisions on this. I think just use it as an exercise. What if we were to face this? How would we work through it? Well, one question would be, how long would this mandate be in place? A church could actually survive a couple months if it had to, but 6 months, 9 months, a year? The longer the ordered shutdown, the more compelling the option would be of disregarding it. Another question, have all the options been explored? Before resorting to civil disobedience, is there a way to make things work in spite of the restrictions? Like meeting outdoors, or meeting in smaller groups, or going virtual, or a combination of those. And are churches really being singled out? If so, then the mandate is clearly discriminatory and intended to stifle Christian worship. And this would give the option of disobedience more weight. If not, then churches should not overreact and then try to turn this whole thing into a "they are suppressing Christian worship" issue, when it's not. Churches in the coastal cities during World War II were not allowed to have evening services due to the blackout. But this applied to everyone. And yet, in the name of public safety, churches willingly complied. They weren't complaining about restrictions on worship. Another question, has relief been sought after through the system itself? This is God's plan, actually. Appeals to the governor, petitions, news conferences, even peaceful protests, and through the courts, pressuring lawmakers to pass emergency legislation that would offer protection for churches is an option. You always start with the least force necessary and escalate from there. Depending on the situation, civil disobedience should be the last resort after all the other avenues have been exhausted. Another question, would civil disobedience in this case foster an anti-government attitude unnecessarily among the members? If disregarding an order becomes the route the church chooses, then it should go out of its way to be respectful in that and encourage a respectful and godly attitude toward both the government and the civil authority that's being disobeyed. Name-calling and mocking insults and words of open defiance and attempts to belittle and defy such leaders do not represent our Lord favorably. Amen? So, again, think respectful noncompliance. And then there would be the question of consistency, which is always a tricky thing. In the name of safety, churches are being required to install fire alarm systems and sprinklers and exit lights and meet numerous building codes and provide handicap accessibility and so on. All of this is an imposition. You should have heard me complain about it when we were remodeling this place. But no one is calling for civil disobedience on any of that. Now, it's not as much of an imposition as forbidding a church to meet, but a church does need to be ready to explain why they're not guilty of a double standard. 30 years ago, John MacArthur was a leading voice against using civil disobedience to save unborn babies, arguing pro-life efforts had nothing to do with the gospel. He was quite vocal in quoting Paul about how civil laws must be obeyed. But now, on something that I consider to be of far less consequence, he has decided otherwise. And I think he needs to explain this. And then we have this question. If the church were to disobey the order, and in this situation hold worship services, what measures would be in place to ensure the safety of those in attendance? The media is having a heyday, had a heyday when they first opened up John MacArthur's church. When they didn't wear masks, they didn't practice social distancing, they freely hugged each other openly, shook hands, and all that stuff. And MacArthur at the media just kind of blew it off, telling them that, well, my people don't buy the narrative. In other words, they don't believe the virus is a threat. So if the church is going to go against the governor's order, it would seem that it would still have a responsibility to respect the public threat that initiated that order. If there is no willingness to do so, then I'm not sure that civil disobedience really is justified. And this leads to the next question. What damage might be done to the church's reputation for defying a mandate like that, like this one? Well, I don't think everything rests on this point, but at the same time, it can't just be lightly dismissed. It has to be a part of the equation. The New Testament writers appealed to this point when arguing for obedience to the state. The reputation of the church, Christ's church, is to be safeguarded. And given how much the media thrives on blaming churches for spreading the virus, I think this itself would require a great deal of pause. The day will come when we will have to take hard stands against the state, and we will be branded as anti-government rebels. But do we want to earn that reputation now over these sorts of things? Could it harden the hearts of outsiders toward us prematurely? I don't know. I honestly don't, but I think it's something we need to think about and talk about. And finally, the big question, the question of harm. Going on the other direction here, what is the harm if we obey? If we comply with the order and don't meet? Well, it's not likely that anyone would fall away from the faith, but possibly some might. But the scriptures clearly exhort believers to meet regularly and often so as to spur one another on toward love and good deeds and so forth. You can't really do that virtually that well. And so it seems that a church is actually on good footing to resist a state order forbidding the gathering of Christians. Indeed, it may be that the harm of not meeting outweighs the harm of meeting, and so non-compliance to the order might actually be called for. But again, I would argue, only as a last resort, and only after working through all those previous questions, and probably questions I've not yet thought of. So again, my purpose here is to help us see the value of thinking things through, and not just react on impulse, to be careful, to be wise, to not be seen as reckless fools, and to be able to adequately defend a decision that is given, given the magnitude of it. When these passages I read earlier from 1 Peter, Titus, 1 Timothy, and Romans were written, do you think that the emperors and governors who were ruling at that time were more harsh or less harsh than the ones ruling over us today? What do you think? Were they more reasonable or less reasonable? Were they more hostile toward Christianity or less hostile? The early apologists, we're talking like 2nd, 3rd centuries here, and trying to gain relief from the persecution, would point out to the emperor a number of compelling reasons to show believers leniency. 1. Christians were model citizens. They were hard workers. They paid their bills. They paid their taxes. They were law-abiding. That's how they argued for leniency. You should think about this, emperor. Secondly, Christians helped Roman society by caring for the poor. Thirdly, Christians honored the emperor and prayed for him persistently. Now, given the sin of idolatry, they could not worship his image, but they did honor and respect him. They did not mock him, defy him, belittle him, that sort of thing. They honored and respected his laws and decrees. The driving point that these early apologists kept focusing on was the fact that Christians were actually good for the empire and they were good for the emperor. Now, I wonder if that could be said of us. Are we seen as supporters or rebels? As compliant and a joy or defiant and a burden? A stubborn? Do civil authorities, or for that matter, outsiders of the faith, see us as blessings or antagonists? What do we convey in our conversations, in our attitudes, in our actions? And what do we convey in our Facebook posts? So I do believe that we have some major battles ahead. At some point, they might forbid sermons condemning homosexuality as sin or homosexual behavior as sin. or forbid churches from counseling those with such struggles to pursue a heterosexual lifestyle. I think that's coming. At some point, they might require us to let transgendered people use the restroom of their choice in church facilities. I think that's coming. At some point, portions of the Bible might be forbidden. We've seen that in other countries. Who knows what lies ahead? Church might not be able to fire a pastor if he comes out as gay. Sermons might have to be approved by the state before they can be given. There's a situation in Texas not long ago where pastors were required to give their sermons to, I think, the state's attorney to review to see if there's any inflammatory language in them. So what we see in other countries, could end up happening here. It could. It's hard to say, but we all know and should be sobered by the fact that religious liberty is at risk. It's something to really be, you know, to be prayerfully contemplating. And we have to really choose our battles carefully in all of this and our attitudes as well. So I'll finally leave you with this thought, something I heard a pastor tell me many years ago, and it just kind of stuck with me. And it goes like this: if you have a problem with submission, then find another religion. Christianity is all about submission. Children submitting to parents, wives submitting to husbands, slaves submitting to masters, Christians submitting to church leaders, citizens submitting to civil authority, all of us submitting to one another, and of course, ultimately, submission to God. So even in those rare times when submission to God requires not submitting to a human authority, such action should be respectful and God-honoring. Josh?